welcome to the show. If it's Thursday night, it's time for Race Trackers. Last week saw one disappointing effort, one medium effort, and one tremendous effort. This week, the racing attention goes to Dubai, where Arrogant will try to win the Dubai World Cup and continue his streak of wins as the world's best horse. I'm Bill Gottemer. My co-hosts, John Stetton and Mike Monroe, will join us later. As you know, each week, we try to capture what has transpired in the racing world and bring new information to our listeners. Please spread the word about how much fun we have here each Thursday night, and please participate. Particularly tonight, since I have no co-host for the first hour, I'd be happy to take any calls from anyone who'd like to call in and discuss some of the races. The number to call in is 646-716-4442. 646-716-4442. Last week, most of the action in the racing world took place at Oaklawn Park in Arkansas. The Azari was a race that saw Terra Promessa, who had a perfect record of 5-for-5 over the Oaklawn Park racetrack, go off at odds on. She received a much-criticized ride by Irad Ortiz, failing to get to the lead and seemingly failing to try to get to the lead as the rider tried to rate her. That seemed to fail miserably as she resented being rating, never got to the lead, and finished off the board and out of the money. There was much discussion on social media about the ride, about the attempt, about the effort put forth by horse and rider. Hard to tell whether it was by design, whether they tried to rate the horse to see whether or not she'd be more competitive going in other races where there was more speed, or whether it just wasn't her day. In any event, we'll see whether or not Terra Promessa rebounds off that poor effort. As you might imagine, when an odds-on horse like that runs out of the money, it caused some tremendous payoffs, particularly in the show pool. The show pool seemed to have a number of bridge jumpers, people who bet tremendous amount of money on short-priced horses to finish third or better. And when she failed to hit the board, that caused some inflated show prices, which it often does. Later on that card, the Rebel, which is a daily Kentucky Derby prep, was won by Todd Putch's Malagasy. But it was less than impressive to many handicappers, as the time and the manner in which he won that race left a lot to be desired. American Anthem, who was ridden by Mike Smith for Bob Baffert, broke badly and reportedly threw a shoe in the race and was never a factor. I'm not sure that this race will factor in the Kentucky Derby picture, but it's yet another runner for Todd Pletcher, who may have as much as a quarter of the field in the Kentucky Derby this year. If the way things look, it looks like Todd Pletcher may have 5, maybe even 6 horses starting in the Kentucky Derby. There's been much discussion about Todd Pletcher's record in the Kentucky Derby. His record is a surprisingly poor 1-for-45. And if he starts 6 horses this year, obviously he'll have at least 5 more losers to add to that. But there tends to be a pattern with Todd Pletcher's horses that they do very well in the Kentucky Derby preps and don't necessarily fire when they finally get to the big race. Malagasy was a horse who was once entered, but was entered and scratched for a claiming price of $75,000. Which tends to make you think that he wasn't quite as impressive before he started, but there's no denying that he's been perfect on the racetrack, now winning three races from 3 starts. He's a son of Shackelford, who you may remember was a Triple Crown contender and a horse who ran well at all distances and had a tremendous amount of heart. Shackelford has turned into be a nice sire for Darby Dan Farms, who now has 2, possibly 3 very successful sires and has a resurgence in the game. On the West Coast, the most impressive race, so Terra Promessa was the disappointing runner. Malagasy was the runner who won but didn't really show much. American Anthem disappointed. But the shining star of the day last week was in California at Santa Anita. In the Santa Margarita Stakes, Val Dori was very impressive, turning back Finest City, and continued her win streak and continues to look like one of the better older fillies and mares in the country right now, riding a win streak and continuing to answer every call. She was ridden in this race by Rafael Bejarano instead of Mike Smith, who was in Arkansas and the Rebel to ride the aforementioned American Anthem. But Val Dori took pressure the entire way and drew off to the stretch like she's a good thing. She seems to have really acclimated to the U.S. and tends to seems to be just getting better and better as time goes on. She paid a very generous $4.30 as she was co-favorite or actually even probably second choice to Finest City. I believe that was tremendous value, particularly at the mile and an eighth distance. Junior Alvarado in racing news, Junior Alvarado returned from his shoulder surgery to win a few races and is back in good form. And congratulations to him. Junior's always been a friend of the show. He's a very strong rider, and you would expect that he'll be even stronger now with the back with his shoulder surgery completed and being back at full strength. As we speak now, we would like to thank our guest from last week, Tony Dutrow. Tony told us that his colt Motown had trained well, and at that time he was undecided between the Florida Derby and the Wood Memorial. It seems today Tony has announced that the Wood Memorial will be the choice, and Javier Castellano will be the rider. So that's a tremendous opportunity for Motown. Let's hope he bounces back to the form that he showed last year before his disappointing effort in down in the fairgrounds. This week is a relatively dull week in racing, but for the extremely world-class card in Dubai. And we'll speak a little bit later about that with John Stetton when he joins us. At this point, I would like to indicate that the show has gone through some changes, and we are looking for more audience participation. So any caller who'd like to call at this time to discuss some things, please call at 646-716-4442. Obviously, the card in Dubai this Saturday morning is tremendous. Each year, the Dubai World Cup undercard just shows some of the best racing in the world, as it's designed to do. It starts at a very early 7:45 a.m. in the East Coast, 10:45 in the even earlier, rather 4:45 a.m. in the West Coast, and it goes all day till about 1 o'clock. I understand that this will be kind of the first time that a racing card will be purposely shown on international airlines, which is tremendous. I mean, I've seen TVG on airplanes before, but that was just one of many channels. But I guess the Dubai World Cup now has managed to put itself fully on a full card on a number of international airlines. So the horse racing game, global as it is now even going above the earth, and that's a race that will be seen. We'll talk about it later. There's a number of North American horses, of course, led by Arrogant. Let me try to give the number one more time, see if we have any callers. The guest call-in number is 646-716-4442. As you know, we've joined a partnership with PassTheWire.com. I'm going to run a quick commercial for them right now. Jonathan Stetton will join us a little bit later.
A gal is like a racehorse. I play her to win.
For the most interesting, exciting, and unique columns and articles in the sport of kings, read Past the Wire by Jonathan Stetton each week. Each and every week, Jonathan brings his unique perspective on the game to readers everywhere. You'll find his columns at PastTheWire.com, along with racing's latest news and so much more. It is truly horse racing uncensored, and you can get Past the Wire delivered right to your inbox each week. Jonathan's own private trip notes, second to none in the game, are even available through his tracking trips. Don't miss out. Visit PassTheWire.com for all the best in the sport of kings. Imitate it, but never duplicate it. PassTheWire.com.
Who's got the action? Just lay it on the line. I'll bet you 10 to 1. Bet you 10 to 1. Bet you 10 to 1. You will be mine.
Well, there we go with Jonathan Stettin, PassTheWire.com. Please take a look at it if you haven't had the opportunity. I'm going to take a quick caller here from the 973 area code. Good evening,
Bill,
you're on
Giovanni.
Racetrackers. Hello, Joe. How
Bill,
are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Just a quick note for your news. Right before the big stakes races at Oaklawn last week, Jack Van Berg and Gary Stevens teamed up to win on a 17-1 shot. Their combined age was 134 years, 137 if you include the horse. And even though it knocked me out of a bet, I had to tip my hat to them.
That's tremendous.
Winning
That's
at that age, so.
Yeah, so what is it, 137 years between the rider?
The rider, trainer, and horse. Van Berg is 80, Gary Stevens, 54, and just back from hip surgery, hip replacement, after a knee replacement a couple of years ago. So that's remarable.
I guess that makes him a little bit younger somehow, if different body parts are.
Maybe I should try that.
I did hear Gary Stevens say that the hip replacement was, and I've heard this from other people too, that the hip replacement was a lot easier to rehab from than the knee replacement.
I read that, yes. I've never had either one and hope I don't, but I'm glad it worked out well for him.
One of the things that impelled Gary Stevens to have the knee replacement, I believe I read somewhere he had a disability policy that paid him till he was 50. That was the age that they expected that his career would end, when he bought the disability policy. So if he was injured, he would be paid a certain amount under that policy until he was 50. And as he approached 50, I guess they had changed and had made advances in knee surgery. And he had a doctor who owned one of the horses that won the Breeders' Cup. I forget the fellow's name. But he did the surgery on Gary Stevens' both knees. And I know that the rehab was a bear, he said.
Well, I suspect the premiums he's paying for a jockey's disability policy, he wanted to get the maximum benefit from that.
I was gonna say, yeah, that's right. What could they be? Is your job dangerous? You know, how many times a day is your job dangerous? Well, Joe, did you see any of the races we spoke about last week? Do you have any thoughts on those?
Let's see. I'm trying to remember it. I missed the Rebel. It was off somewhere for that. And gosh, I'm trying to remember the other ones.
Well, the Azari with Terra Promessa was the one that got the big discussion on the internet.
Big upset.
Yeah, and Irad Ortiz got a tremendous amount of criticism, which I don't know if it's warranted or not. I mean, it's certainly the criticism that says it was dishonest isn't warranted, because I don't believe that. You know, that's just reckless for people to say that. But I don't know if they purposely tried to rate her, or she just broke bad and they thought that was the best way to be, or that he thought that was the best style. It was not what everybody expected.
Whatever it was, it sure didn't work.
Yeah, that's right. Either it does or it doesn't, and it didn't. Do you have any Derby thoughts so far? Do you have a favorite yet that you're leaning towards?
I really haven't focused much on it yet, and I think it's more wide open than most people believe. But I have not really homed in on that yet. And usually I don't, and until the last month or two, I usually don't, because so many of them drop off the Derby trail. I would never bet on one of these futures bets, because, most of those horses never go to the post.
Right. You know how fragile they are. Well, speaking of which, I guess they had two big runners work this week. McCracken worked out and worked out very well. And McCracken had missed a race due to a minor injury. So he seems to be back on track, if that work is indicative. But Classic Empire refused to work, which is which is not a good sign. You know, he refused to work at all. He stood still and he wouldn't move, and they couldn't get him to do anything. And they eventually put the work off for the next day, and he ran. But he worked pretty well. But you know, that type of temperament for Classic Empire doesn't bode well for 140,000 screaming people at Churchill Downs.
No, if he can't do it in the morning with, you know, just a handful of people watching. Well,
yeah.
What do you make of Gunnar Vera?
Well, he's done nothing wrong, right? You know, he's done nothing wrong. All his success has come in Florida. I have become increasingly suspicious of Florida form because it doesn't seem to translate anywhere else, and that may or may not be due to kind of lax oversight in Florida for medication, which is now known as one of the more lax states. So I'm suspicious of any form in Florida because it just doesn't seem to translate so well when they leave Florida. But he's certainly done nothing wrong. He has the right style, right? He's another one who's by a Darby Dan sire, by a Dialed In, who's turned out to be a nice sire. Javier Castellano has not committed to ride him yet. And I was a little surprised, that he hasn't. But, I mean, he seems to be as good as any, right?
Yeah. He really had a powerful turn of foot there. Who else is Castellano on? What are other possibilities?
I don't know. As I said, he's going to ride Motown in the Wood Memorial. And presumably, you know, he and John Velazquez would have their choice of the six or seven Todd Pletcher runners, right? I mean, I guess I would, you know, he rides, you know, Nick Tomorrow makes the point, who's a very good handicapper, makes the point that Todd Pletcher could start six or seven horses in the Derby and not have one of them be favored. You know, so I'm not so sure that's good for the game, but
embarrassment of riches.
Yeah. I mean, which all you remember, it's so different, right? I mean, there used to be so many more trainers because they limited trainers to 20 or 40 stalls depending on how big you are. But there was never any super bonds like there are now, you know, 200, 300 horses.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess Van Berg was one of the first to do that. You know, he had a big operation, you know, mostly the Midwestern tracks, but he had a
right.
You know, that 20 years ago, but a lot of them do now. And
yeah,
you're right, there are fewer of the small onesies and twosies guys.
Yeah, I mean, I think now, I'm thinking mostly of New York. I guess it was permitted in the Midwest earlier than it was in New York. But New York, even, you know, even the Phipps stable, or even the top guys, you know, Woody Stevens, I don't think he ever had more than 40. It just wasn't considered good. And that's back, I guess, when they had the trainer entry rule. So everybody who ran from the same trainer was an entry. And I guess that was another reason why the racing secretaries didn't want to give too many stalls to one trainer, because you're constantly running, you know, entries all the time. I mean, if they had that rule now, you'd have three betting interests in New York many times.
Well, good. I've enjoyed your shows, and I like your current format a lot better.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, we're going through some changes, and you know, one of the problems we have here is everybody works for a living, so you know, everybody has families, and it's hard to commit to a full schedule. So Mike joins us when he can. Jonathan Stetton will join us at 9:00. But we're going to try to have more people call in and more people participate. And you know, we're happy with the guests we have. We don't have a big guest this week because everybody's in Dubai, and the difficulty of some of the difficulty of having people call from Dubai, it can be done, but at some point it just becomes easier to just give everybody a week off. But thank you for the compliment, and thank you for calling in, and you know, always appreciate your opinion. Have you had an opportunity to listen to the Steve Cawthon interview?
I have not. No,
back.
And I've been meaning to do that. I've been behind on these. You know, we're an hour time difference from you, and I'm in New Orleans, and for some reason, largely due to work, what do they say? Work is the curse of the drinking class. Do I have that line right?
That's right.
I always get my times off, but I mean to catch that Coffin interview. But I've heard it was a good one.
Well, the good news is I'm going to run it. I'm going to run part of it now because, as I said, I'm waiting for my co-host to join at 9. So, Joe, I'll hang up with you, and I'm going to run the Coffin interview for 30 minutes or so, and I hope people will enjoy it because it was a good one. It's racing history. So,
good.
I hope you'll enjoy it. And then we'll pick up live again at 9 o'clock. Thank you, Joe.
Okay. Thank you.
So thank you to Joe Bonney for calling in. We'll take one more opportunity to see if anybody wants to call in, 646-716-4442. And then, as I said, we'll run the Steve Coffin interview for those of you who haven't heard it, and we'll pick up live again at 9 o'clock with Jonathan Stetton.
Good evening. Welcome to Race Trackers. I'm delighted to announce we have Steve Coffin as our guest tonight. Good evening, Steve.
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
Fine, thanks. Steve, we're so happy to have you on the show tonight. It seems like only yesterday to a lot of us, but it was 40 years ago. It was 40 years ago in 1977 for some of our listeners who are younger, when you set the world on fire in New York this month with an astounding, I believe it was 77 wins in the month of February. Is that correct?
You know, I don't even know, but I do remember I had 23 in 1 week. Or something, but I can't remember. But I didn't know about the month.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite a time, you know. Now in New York, I don't even know if we run 77 races in the month of February. But you know, but back then, we're so happy to have you on, and you know, obviously your accolades are so many. It's hard to go through, and I don't want to embarrass you, but for our listeners, you've won every possible award that could be as a jockey. And really had the distinction of being Sports Illustrated Sports Person of the Year, which is something an Associated Press Male Athlete of the Year and a Sporting News Pro Athlete of the Year. It's the likes of notoriety that racing doesn't normally get in the wider range of things. So obviously congratulations on that distinction.
Thank you. It was an exciting time, for sure.
I mean, when we speak about it, and again, so many of our listeners are younger, and you know, it was back in the day when we didn't have information that was so readily available. And if I remember correctly, when you were the leading apprentice in New York, and you know, in 1977, you would be listed. The entries didn't come out till the night before because the entries weren't taken very early, and there was no advanced daily racing form. But you would come out and you would be listed on numerous horses at that time. Everybody wanted you to ride their horse. Do I recall that correctly, that you'd be listed on 3 or 4 horses?
Yeah. And I mean, that was, as you say, I think, you know, a lot of guys were trying to get me on their horse. And as you say, there was quite a few jockeys there, but, you know, they allowed my agent to do that, and then, you know, I think there was a certain time where they had to secure, you know, an exact jockey. Once, you know, we figured out what we were going to do, and then, you know, they had to, you know, everybody else had to get, you know, somebody else.
It's a scramble for all the other rides.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just a tremendous run, and I remember, I don't know whether you recall this, but at least in racing circles, you know, the Eagles had a big song, said, you know, there's a new kid in town, and you were it. You know, when you came to New York, you kind of took it by storm. There was no question about it. And again,
it was crazy. I remember when I had to run, they made me go get my working papers. That was like a big deal, whether I was going to be able to get my working papers and
Because you were too young to ride in New York, or you had to have working papers to ride in New York.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know. I was just it was just something that all of a sudden they said you have to do this or else you can't ride, and it was a big panic. And there was in the paper that, you know, there was a big caricature of it the next day. You know, Coffin gets his racing paper, his working papers.
That's great. Well, you know, there were, again, for our listeners who weren't around, it was so unbelievable because the numbers are different. But you earned $6 million in 1977. Your horses earned $6 million in purses. Mm-hmm. And that was considered unthinkable. I mean, you won like over 400 races, almost 500 races. But the $6 million number, and it coincided with a popular television show called The $6 Million Man, which was Lee mm-hmm. Majors and, I guess, Farrah Fawcett. I remember them.
Right.
Sports Illustrated saying, right, you were the new $6 million man.
Yep, yep. That was, like you said, I think the Angel Cordero had the previous record, which was like $4 million something. So, yeah, it was at that time quite a step up. Like you said, nowadays it's like nothing, but it was, you know, like 487 races, I think it was. So
okay.
It was, I was working hard that year.
Yeah, but, no kidding.
But it was, like you said, it was, I think I won six races three times that year, maybe at Aqueduct.
Amazing. Back when the stands were full most days too.
Yeah, right. Well, I was talking to somebody the other day, you know, and even in the winter, you know, back in 77, 76, 77, that winter, you know, it wasn't unusual just on a regular weekday to have 10,000 people, you know, or 10 or 12,000 people, and on the weekends, you know, sometimes more. Of course, obviously the Wood, I think the Wood, you know, was more like 50,000, 45 or 50,000 back then, you know.
Right.
And, I mean, you don't get that on the Breeders' Cup there, you know, not much more. So.
Right. It's all moved to television and on a computer.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure there's fewer people watching, but there's certainly fewer people
right,
watching.
No, right, yeah, right,
live.
Right, exactly. I'm just saying, yeah, that actually shows up at the racetrack, yeah.
Right. Well, if 1977 wasn't exciting enough for you, 1978 came along, and actually, late in 1977, you started riding Affirmed, and you started those battles
right.
with Affirmed and Allie Darren. And I think I saw all the New York ones as a kid, and I guess I kind of always thought that the only time Allie Darren seemed to beat Affirmed was an Affirmed didn't see him, and I think that happened once in his 2-year-old career. I don't remember exactly
yep.
what race it was, but he seemed like he passed
Champagne,
you far
yeah.
on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the Champagne,
yeah.
he passed you far on the outside.
And it was a muddy track too, which was another thing that wasn't Affirmed's favorite thing.
Okay.
You know, he ran on it, but he wasn't quite as confident and as you know, I just think he was better on a normal fast track. There was kind of two things that day. But, yeah, you're right. Aladar, came wide and on the outside, he got by me, and I didn't have time to reengage. Just sort of he made such a, he accelerated so well on that track that, I just didn't have time to get back at him.
Right. And that set up kind of the rivalry. And when you moved into 1978, you know, again, for our listeners, you know all this, of course, but just for our listeners who may have been younger and have heard about it but not been around, you were with Affirmed was owned by Harborview Farm, who was Lou Wilson and trained by Laz Barrera, and you were up against the old guard in Calumet Farm. Alidar was owned by Calumet Farm and John Veach, and there was probably, I think there was probably in the racing commentators, and there were only few of them back then, there was probably a feeling that Allie Dahl would get the better of Affirmed at some point due to his breeding and kind of a nostalgia back to Calumet being the I don't think it was mean-spirited, but it seemed like it was always, no matter how many times Affirmed won, there were people saying, well, Allie Dahl almost got there, was going to get there. And throughout all that, I guess no one told you and no one told Affirmed, right, that he was supposed
right.
to get passed
right.
by.
Thank God. Thank God. It was kind of a unique build up, and like you said, it started as 2-year olds. I rode the first time I rode Affirmed against Aladar was in the Hopewell, and that's the day that I really realized what a special horse he was, and that Aladar was also. Because we just I'd never at that point in my career accelerated down the stretch, the stretch like I'd did in that race. And, they went well clear of the rest of the field. And he held, Affirmed beat Aladar by, half a length or whatever it was. And then we came back to the New York to Belmont for the Futurity, and I beat him in those. And then, you know, a few weeks later, Aladar beat me in the Champagne. So luckily for us, you know, neither we or them were afraid of each other. You know, we both, you know, were very confident in our horses. And Lez kind of talked, you know, kind of challenged them to take us on in the Laurel. We were going to go to Laurel, you know. He said, if Aladar can come, if he thinks he's good enough, type of thing.
Right.
And luckily they did. And then, you know, so we beat them in the Laurel Futurity and, you know, ended up getting the two-year-old champion, you know, that year in the Eclipse Awards. And then, like you said, you know, we went to the West Coast and they went to the East Coast for the winter. And, you know, that was the exciting, you know, build up to the 1978 Derby.
Right. And I mean, you moved to the Derby and you moved to the Preakness, and now you're on to the Belmont. And, you know, I guess Seattle Slough had just won a Triple Crown the year earlier, and Secretariat had won it a few years before that in 1973. But there was still excitement with the Triple Crown, and there was still kind of a belief that Ali Daw would get a measure of revenge in the longer distance. And with that, he decided to kind of engage you earlier. And there's a famous race call, and I've always disputed this, and I want to get your opinion on this. Is, and not to criticize, I believe it was Chick Anderson, the race caller, but he said Ali Daw puts a head in front. And I've never really seen that in the stretch into Belmont. Did he ever actually get ahead of you?
He certainly got even with me. Whether he got, you know, if he got ahead of me, it was a nostril, you know, or, you know, it wasn't very far, but, it was, you know, he certainly, you know, he was even with me at one point there. You know, I mean, I thought, you know, it was a hell of a call. I mean, I remember, you know, I think Chick Anderson was one of the best of all time. And, you know, not only, you know, his call with Secretariat, but also that one, you know, it was a heck of a call. And, you know, it just, you know, showed, you know, like two champions. It was almost like a boxing call, you know.
Right.
You know, like they, you know, like it was with those two. You know, it was almost an Ali Frazier kind of, you know, back and forth. You know, nobody knew what was going to happen till we got past the finish line.
Right.
I didn't know. You know, I mean, I knew at the head of the lane that my horse was, you know, he felt a little bit fatigued under me. Aladar was right there fighting, you know, and that's the first time I ever hit him left-handed. But, you know, and being the gutsy horse he was, he just dug in deep and, you know, got his head back in front. And once he did, you know, I just felt like, you know, we were going to hang in there, but which we did. But I think it was Bill Knack that, you know, he said it was like Moby Dick or looking back at Ahab, you know, it was one of the,
yeah,
you know, this, you, it, you know, just a real dogfight, you know. And, you know, the amazing thing was Aladar kept coming back after, you know, all those tight defeats, you know. So, yeah, I don't even think he probably ever knew he was losing, you know. He probably thought he won.
Well, there is a certain solace in that for horses' connections, right, that they know they lost, but sometimes the horses don't when it's that tight. I guess Mike Smith said that about Songbird this year when he lost to Holden, that she's unaware of the fact that, you know, the wire came up at the wrong time. Well, through the whole thing, it was so exciting, and I'll tell you an aside, on my aside, I was selling mutual tickets at Belmont that day.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, and they had at that time, they thought it was a good idea not to have television in the bays, so you couldn't watch the races live where you were working, watch them on television where you're working, but you could bring, you had to bring your money to the money room after each race. So I remember scrambling up with my money to get to the money room and finding a spot, a perch to watch it on one of the catwalks on the TV.
Right.
And I was younger and probably more interested in it than anybody, and I got a front row seat and I can see it. And people were asking me what I saw because they couldn't see it. So I delivered kind of a word by word description to the people who couldn't see it. And I had no doubt you had won the photo. It was just tremendously, tremendously exciting. And at such a young age, it just must have been a tremendous amount of pressure, but you handled it with such aplomb, it seemed. And as did the connections of Alidar. It was just something the whole racing world should have been proud of. You know,
I think they should too. I think, as you say, I think they were very good. John Veitch was. You know, I know it killed him, but
right.
He was. You know, like you said, just like it would have killed us if we'd have gotten beaten the Belmont. You know, because it would have. You know, we wouldn't have been able to fulfill the dream of trying to win the Triple Crown. But, you know, that's what it's all about. That's what sports is about. And, kind of, you know, the same, you know, like winning or losing the Super Bowl. You know, it's just the biggest day in racing. And, you know, I thought they did handle it, you know, fantastically well. It was a truly classic fight all the way through.
Right, just so exciting. And then, you know, we won't go on with it. As it turned out, you weren't riding him when he was disqualified in the Travers. And we've discussed this on our show before. What a shame that was. That was another matchup that never really came to pass because of some unfortunate walk on the racetrack.
Yeah.
But you decided to leave New York. You moved to California for a little while.
I followed the firm to California, you know. He went back out there for the next fight. Yeah, so the only reason that I was, you know, going to California was really, you know, to go with the firm. Yeah,
right.
And Laz, you know. So
and his four-year-old.
You know,
right.
And I had done that the winter before, you know, so it wasn't any, you know, it wasn't any big deal. Any, you know, the real thing was is I had a fall up at Saratoga that summer and fractured my knee. And I was out for about 2 months or a month and a half, you know, almost, you know, 6 or 8, 7 weeks, I can't remember. You know, when I came back, you know, it was just, I had a hard time getting things back, you know, back going again. You know,
okay.
It was slow to get started. And then soon after that, we went out to California, which obviously wasn't my backyard. My agent, Lenny Goodman, had a heart attack, and he was recovering from that. And, so eventually we got out there, but, you know, Laz's horses, you know, we'd had a long, hard year. And, you know, they just, right at the beginning of the year, you know, they weren't really, we didn't get off to, any kind of a start at all. Just kind of horses were getting beat, you know, that were favorites. And, you know, it's one of those things, you know, it doesn't matter how, you know, much success you've had. You know, you're only as good as your last, you know, win, really, in reality, in anything, you know.
Right.
No matter, you know, let Tom Brady, you know, lose for a while, and, you know, everybody will just say he's washed up.
So that's
what they were saying about me, you know. And, you know, they were pretty hard on me pretty quick, and it just kind of, you know, I lost some confidence. And, you know, just kind of one thing led into another, and I went through a pretty long losing streak. Which, you know, it sounds, but, you know, it all happened probably in about 3.5 weeks, you know.
Right.
But, you know, I never gave up. I mean, I kept fighting and kept trying. And eventually, although I lost the mount on Affirmed, you know, I ended up, you know, finally winning the race for Laz, you know.
Okay.
He gave me a mount on a horse called Father Duffy, and, you know, we had won. And I won a few other races, you know, but it just... You know, it was a struggle because, you know, all the other California trainers weren't offering me, you know, mounts, or if they were, they weren't offering me good ones, you know. I was just getting scrubs, you know, whatever was left over. And, you know, out of the blue, I got an offer to go to Europe. So from, you know, an owner who I'd ridden some for out in California, he had, you know, sent a few horses out there for the winter, and Robert Sangster. And, you know, he had a huge stable over in Europe. Most of his best horses were with Vincent O'Brien, but he also had a pretty good-sized stable in England with a trainer called Barry Hills. And so he came and offered me the job to go over to England and ride for Barry Hills. And they had a pretty good they'd had a horse called Hawaiian Sound who had just finished second, you know, the year before in the Epsom Derby. And so, you know, he was obviously going to be one of my mounts. And I just decided it was a good time to, you know, try a new challenge and try something different. You know, things had kind of gone the wrong way for me at that point, and I didn't see any reason not to give it a chance. And the other thing that Mr. Sangster mentioned to me, he says, long term, you're going to end up in Europe anyway because of your weight. And,
right.
You know, as it turned out, you know, that was very true. And after thinking about it, I said, I want to give it a shot. And so I did.
Well, you're being too modest because Robert Sangster and Vincent O'Brien, for our listeners, were really European racing royalty at the time. As you said, they were a huge, powerful stable. And
right.
and for them to reach out to you was had to be a tremendously source of tremendous pride.
Yeah, I was honored. You know, like you said, I felt like, you know, it was a shot in my arm, especially at that time. And you know, went like anything. You know, kind of like Nick Cannon. You know, you know, you want to work for people that want you. You know, so
right.
I decided that it was a good time to give it a try.
And that was uncommon at the time. There weren't many riders who went to Europe to ride.
I was the first in a long time. I mean, you know, through history there had been a few, you know, Todd Sloan, you know, and a few others that had gone over and had some, you know, quite a bit of success. But it hadn't happened for quite a while. Mainly too because. You know, American racing had been doing so well, you know, so guys wasn't like, you know, the purse structures in England are, you know, on the day-to-day basis are a little less. You know, the big races are pretty good, but, you know, day-to-day, I mean, you know, some of the races are, you know, pretty low, you know, even at what, you know, they consider decent meets.
Right.
So, you know, it wasn't like, you know, I mean, the one thing is, you know, you get a job and you get a retainer, but, it wasn't, you know, wasn't something that a lot of people were dying to rush across there to do. But, you know, my situation, you know, I got a good offer, and I thought it was worth, you know, trying.
Well, it was a world of experience for you. I mean, you got to ride and win big races in Great Britain, France, Germany, Ireland, Italy. I was lucky enough to see your victory in the Irish Derby in when you rode Old Vic in 1989.
Right.
I was
mm-hmm.
at the Curragh with my wife and sisters. That was back when I had money and energy and I was working for Pan Am, so we had free flights, so we went to races all over the world, you know. So
cool.
I cashed a bet on you. It was a decent sized
good.
Price with Old Vic, and
yeah.
it was just tremendous amount of excitement. Now, on a personal note, if I remember correctly, you spent enough time in England that you developed an English accent for a little while. Am I right about that?
I definitely did, yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, the thing was that I was really, I hadn't even turned 19 by the time I went over to England. I was, you know, like about 2 months shy of my 19th birthday. So, yeah, I was still young and, you know, I wasn't like I tried to pick up an English accent, but it's just kind of like... Yeah, it just happens. You know, you're around it. You know, you find out what people. You know, just you hear other people talk, and you know what they say to get what they want. So you know, it's easier to do it. You know, if you explain it the way they do, and it just kind of happened. So
right.
I did have a pretty strong accent. By the time when I got home, within a year, it just basically disappeared.
That's funny.
Just being back home.
I remember, and I don't remember exactly what race it was. I guess it was the English Derby. But I guess a couple of times you've met the Queen at the races, right? When she gives out the trophy, and that's
right.
Got to be
the Queen and the Queen Mother were the main two who gave the trophies out at Ascot, and so yeah, I actually got to know the Queen Mother quite well, and
really?
Obviously met the Queen quite a few times, and you know she. Gave me quite a few trophies through the years. And Princess Anne, got to know her quite well. I met Princess Diana. She was after I won my first Derby on slip anchor because she had gone to the races that day, and you go up to the Royal Box after winning the Derby.
Right.
So that was cool. Yeah, I mean, you know, the fact that royalty's so involved in racing is, you know, a really cool thing in, you know, English racing.
Well, it's hard to imagine people like us working with royalty and being the Queen other than in the racing world. I mean, it's one of the wonderful things about the racing world, right? You get to go everywhere and see everyone.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I met Eric Clapton and Elton John and Roger Waters and all that through racing, you know, because they had some connection one way or the other, and it was pretty cool.
Now, I've told this story on the air before, but I forget which Derby it was. It was the Epsom Derby, and I'm trying to think who won it. But I was there, and Princess Di and Sarah Ferguson were in the royal box, and someone streaked down the center of the course. That was all
right.
The rage then, people streaking.
Right,
And the Queen stood up and turned her back, and Princess Di stood up and turned her back, but I think Sarah Ferguson was in hot water because being
the
American she was. Yeah, she leaned out of the box and raised the glass and had a few laughs with people as they caught it on the course.
Yeah. Now they always gave her a hard time. They gave Princess Di, the royal family seemed to give Princess Di a hard time, but they definitely gave Fergie a tough time all the way through. But I got to meet her a few times, and she seemed like a really nice gal, and she seems like she's tried hard to get everything back on track for herself and her kids. So
right,
you know, I got nothing but good things to say about her.
Well,
that definitely happened in the press over there a lot. They picked and chose who they were fans of and who not.
it shows you how fast.
Overall, they were pretty good to me.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's just a tremendous world of experience. It's amazing how fame is fleeting. I mean, I don't have to tell you. You were famous. I never was. But when I mentioned to my kids, you know, Fergie, they're talking about the singer for the Black Eyed Peas. They don't even realize
right.
It was what somebody was.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
You know, royalty. But well, Steve, you came back and you're back in Kentucky. And
I am.
You're still an ambassador to the game, and I know you make various appearances. What do you think of the state of the game today? I'm sure you're pleased with how it's going, but do you have any particular thoughts about things in the future?
You know, I think there's certainly good things, and things that are tough. Technology's been good in a lot of ways, as you say. I mean, people can be involved with racing and not actually be there, but of course that makes it tough for racetracks and stuff. When people don't actually show up at the venue. I just think racing's kind of. I think at one point there was just too many horses and too many races. I remember before I really started, I guess they said back in the day, there wasn't really racing in the winter in New York or up that in the East.
Right.
And that, the break, whether it was whatever it was, 2 months or 3 months, whatever it was something that was good in the end because when racing came back, everybody couldn't wait. It's kind of like baseball. I mean, can you imagine playing baseball 365 days a year?
Right.
I mean, the same sort of thing. It's like some too much of anything, even a good thing, cannot be the best for the sport. So, I think that obviously, keeping the quality up and having maybe slightly less, racing overall is probably something that, is just going to happen naturally. Just I think that's the way it's going to be. Like as you said, back in the day, we were racing 6 days a week, year round up in New York. It was just the way it was. And now it's
right.
Down to, 4 or 5 days a week up there. And, some places like here at Turfway in Kentucky, it's, in the winter they race about 4 days a week. But, the big thing is, you have to keep the, keep the fans. You have to keep generating and creating new fans, And as you say, there's a lot of young people that, there's just so many other options. Back in 1977, 78, there wasn't all the other, I think maybe the lottery was about to come in.
Right.
Or came in soon after that, around that time. But there wasn't legal gambling on all these other things. So, racing's just got a ton more competition, And I just think, I mean, I don't claim to know, you know, the answer, you know, so to speak, but I think, you know, obviously somehow we have to attract newer, younger fans and people that, you know, it's kind of like one of the things, you know, once you're around it, you know, it grabs you, you know, but you
right.
have to get people actually to the facility, to the track, and seeing the beauty of horses and, you know, the competition, you know, how great, exciting it is to have a, you know, a race like the Alice Dara Firm, you know, Belmont, or Sunday Silence and Easy Goer, you know, those kind of things are great fillies, you know, like Ruffian, you know,
right.
just are spectacular performances, and then of course great competition, and yeah, so you know, I, like I said, it's hard to say what it, there's not exactly one thing. Yeah, you know, I also kind of tend to think that basically people are right. You know, I mean, we have to have some sort of, you know, unified drug rules, like, you know, and obviously less or, you know, next to none is probably the best, you know, but it has to be universal. You know, you can't have it one way here and one way, it's a different way someplace else. You know, I think it should, you know, be like a universal situation for everybody all around
right.
the country.
Well, it just adds another level of complexity for
right.
gamblers, trainers, owners, everyone involved. I mean, you have
yeah.
you wind up having people have many drug positives and go unscathed, and other people have minute drug positives and have their reputations tarnished, and it
right.
doesn't seem to everybody
seem to be, yeah it doesn't seem like everybody's getting treated equally. You're right.
Right, the people outside the game don't know what to think. The people inside the game just roll their eyes because they,
yeah.
they doesn't,
they're,
you know,
the
doesn't.
Lucky ones to get away with it. Yeah, they're happy. they're not.
right.
They're basically yeah out of a job. So,
right,
it's pretty tough.
Well, I take some solace in the fact that I think television exposure, and I've written a little article on this, but I think television exposure is really what made other sports gallop ahead of, no pun intended, gallop ahead of.
I agree. Yeah.
Horse racing, and now I am heartened when I hear young people talk about the vagaries of different tracks, the way people used to talk about different ballparks. You know, the idea
right.
that somebody who's 18 years old in New York knows that Hawthorne Racetrack, you know, has tight turns, is something that never could have happened 30 or 40 years ago. You didn't.
Yeah.
You were lucky if anybody knew that it existed. You know, and so I think the television exposure will help, and I think. You know, I think the game is kind of settling in to a point where, you know, there are big days. I do think that from a gambling standpoint, when we do this show, it seems like every racetrack gives their best races on Saturday, which is a natural. But the Sunday cards are turning out to be weak. So I think some racetracks
right.
should pick up
yeah,
the...
balance it out. Yeah, you're right. Try to, you know, like you said, especially if you're going up against, you know, New York, you know, on Saturday, who's got a huge card, you know, if you're New Jersey or, you know, Monmouth or somewhere else, you know, you should move your big races to Sunday. Yeah, I agree.
Right. Yeah, somewhere along the line.
Try to balance it out.
Yeah, somewhere along the line they thought that the quality on Sunday doesn't matter. And I guess if the quality doesn't matter, why do it on Sunday? You know, but I guess
right.
that would be the one change I would make. And I certainly hope New York gets its act together because they have big old aging facilities, and I don't know how long they're going to be able to keep the facilities that are largely unused, you know, most of the time. So somewhere along the
right.
line, that's got to be modernized. And I hope they bring the Breeders' Cup back to New York. But largely, I'm happy with how the game is shaking out these days, and it's still as exciting as ever. No question about that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you watch Beholder and Mike's filly, the Songbird, you
right.
know, fight it out. You know, that was an amazing race. And of course, you know, Arrogate, you know, coming around and doing what he's done, you know, obviously California Chrome, you know, they're just, as you say, there's no end of exciting horses. It's an exciting year every year leading up to the Derby and the Triple Crown races, because you don't know what's going to happen. You know, all of a sudden, you know, a horse can just, you know, come on,
right.
you know, and just really develop, you know, right at the right time. You know, they may not make the Triple Crown, but, you know, they come good at, you know, Preakness, and then, you know, finish the rest of the year and turn into, you know, a really superstar. And, you know, it's a great game. And as you say, it's just a question of, you know, I think I agree with you. I think, you know, people were, you know, were afraid, the racing people were afraid of television, you know, thinking that, you know, that it wouldn't would keep people away from the track, and to some degree, I guess that's true. But, you know, like you said, nowadays they can be involved, you know, wherever they're at, even
right.
if they're not at the track. So, as you say, there's a lot of good things, and the big thing is, you know, hopefully, like you said, more and more young people are starting to understand, you know, more about the game, and it's probably easier in some ways because of the technology to learn, you know, a lot about racing, you know, without actually having to be at the track all the time.
Right. But we have people who call up and tell me about handicapping methods where they watch replays of the races simultaneously from the head on and the pan shot. That's something that,
right.
you know,
yeah.
we couldn't have done.
Never
and it's
said,
a,
no.
Right. Just unbelievable.
No, I mean, like you said, it's great because, you know, you can watch a race anywhere around the country, you know, pretty much any time of the day or night. In the middle of the night, you can watch races in Australia if you want to, in the middle, if you want to stay up and, you know, and watch it
at
2 in the morning, you know.
Steve, you and I are the same age, and so, you know, sleeping gets more difficult as you get older. But I get up in the middle of the night anyway, but I set my alarm for 1:25 in the morning the other day and watched Winx win her 14th straight race in Australia. You know, and
yeah.
my wife just kind of shook her head, you know, and said, well, I should be used to this by now, you know.
Yeah, people that aren't as entwined to it as we are don't really understand, but I guess it's the same with a lot of things. I don't
exactly.
understand why, you know, you said why people want to stay up all night and watch Dancing with the Stars or something.
Well, to see Victor Espinosa, I guess. But,
yeah, I guess that's that I would stay up for.
Well, Steve, I'm so proud to have you on. I can't thank you enough, and I know you have things to do tonight. I can't thank you enough for being on here. You know, we're a small show, but we put out a quality product, and we have loyal listeners, and we just, you know, each week we try to speak with racing personalities, and I really didn't want, you know, the 40-year anniversary of you setting New York on fire in February to go unnoticed, I can't tell you how thankful we are for being on, and what a great response we've gotten from people who you know, who are excited to hear this interview. So I can't thank you enough. Please, I certainly hope you won't be a stranger, and I hope
all
when
the
we
best
get
to you, and like you said, keep watching the races and going to the track and enjoying, you know, the greatest sport on earth.
Great, thank you so much, Steve Cawthon, everyone. Thanks again, Steve.
Well, I hope I know some of you have heard that interview before, and I apologize for replaying it. But he's such a historic figure that I did want to get it on and make sure people had heard it. And he was so involved in racing and really did set the world on fire back in 1977 with a run that was to this day has not been matched. And of course his run with Affirmed, as he discussed, was you know, just tremendous. So a few minutes we'll talk about Dubai, and we'll have Jonathan Stettin join us, I believe.
For the most interesting, exciting, and unique columns and articles on the sport of kings, read Past the Wire by Jonathan Stettin each week. Each and every week, Jonathan brings his unique perspective on the game to readers everywhere. You'll find his columns at pastthewire.com, along with racing's latest news and so much more. It is truly horse racing uncensored, and you can get Past the Wire delivered right to your inbox each week. Jonathan's own private trip notes, second to none in the game, are even available through his tracking trip. Don't miss out. Visit pastthewire.com for all the best in the sport of kings. Imitate it, but never duplicate it. Pastthewire.com.
Say, Baron, what horse did you play today? I'm sweet potato. Did she win? Did she play? Well, she showed.
Well, as we spoke earlier, this week the world's racing world's attention turns to Dubai. It's a beautiful facility, has opulence beyond belief. I'm told from everyone who goes there that it's something that you've like something like you've never seen before. I hope to have the opportunity to go there someday in my life. From this part of the world, though, watching it on TVG is a delight because you get to get up early and watch races from 7:45 a.m. in the morning. And since Maidan, the racetrack in Dubai, has gone back to a dirt surface from a synthetic surface, they have New York, U.S. horses and New York horses, but U.S. horses in particular, have done very, very well. And there'll be a lot of familiar names on the card in Dubai this Saturday morning if you get up early. And right at 7:45 a.m., the Godolphin Mile is a race that we'll see Sharp Azteca. And he'll lead he's a tremendous sprinter here in the U.S., and he'll lead a field of 13 where a horse called North America, ironically, a horse who's not based in North America, but his name is North America, is the favorite and the horse to beat. But Sharp Azteca is tremendous up to a mile. He's very fast. He has world-class speed. And we may get to see that they start off with an American winner. Ironically, this is one of the few horses where I've ever heard a trainer say the horse does better with company on the lead. Most horses who run on the lead prefer to be left alone so they can get into an easy rhythm. But Sharp Azteca seems to thrive on the idea of having some tremendous competition. So one of the fears that trainer Jorge Navarro has is that there won't be enough speed to get Sharp Azteca interested. But either way, I think Sharp Azteca will be a formidable force in that race and probably a square price because my guess is that the bettors in various places around the world won't realize how fast he actually is. From there, there's a couple of interesting races. We won't go over all of them. If Jonathan Stetton joins us later, we might. But when I move to the fourth race, it's two interesting races, two horses there. And what's interesting about that is there's 2 3-year-olds in this race, and both of them could possibly have Kentucky Derby aspirations. So a big effort by either Master Plan for Todd Pletcher or Epicaris, who has run extremely well in overseas, might thrust them into the Kentucky Derby picture, which we spoke about earlier, is completely wide open. Thunder Snow, an older horse, will be the favorite in that race. The fifth race is a race where the only there's a horse trained by Bill Mott, a horse called Long on Value, and apropos of his name, Long on Value is listed as 30-1 in the morning line and might be even higher. Bill Mott is an accomplished, wonderful horseman who's gone to Dubai successfully with Cigar, and certainly probably wouldn't go there if he didn't think he had a tremendous opportunity. So I would keep an eye on Long on Value, not necessarily to bet, but certainly a horse to expect to show him a good effort. The race that's most interesting, I think, for American viewers other than the World Cup would be the Golden Shuheen. It's 6 furlongs, it's a $2 million race, and it has a lot of familiar names in it. We'll start with the most familiar name that we have here and who will be the favorite, and it's Mind Your Biscuits. Mind Your Biscuits, ridden by Joel Rosario, has drawn the outside post, 14 post, probably never a good thing. Don't mind being outside, but that's particularly far outside. That might compromise his chances, although he does come from off the pace somewhat, and that still might compromise his chances. I'm sure they can't be happy with that. One of the things to notice about this race is all the horses in the race carry a very high impost, or the older horses at least, carry a very high impost of 132 pounds. So this will be the first time that Mind Your Biscuits or any of the new U.S. horses, for that matter, have carried that much weight. Mind Your Biscuits finished a very fast closing second to Unified last month down in Gulfstream Park. Probably had a bit of an overconfident ride under Joel Rosario, but certainly got what he needed out of it, and he will be a formidable force even with the outside post. The outside post does make him vulnerable, though. On the opposite side of the starting gate, all the way to the inside, will be David Jacobson's Stall Walking Dude. Stall Walking Dude shows up every time. He's a 7-year-old. He's had 50 lifetime starts, 17 wins. Has in fact run nonstop throughout last year, 2016, and has had two good efforts in 2017, albeit not winning ones. Stall Walking Dude, will try Maidan for the first time, but David Jacobson has taken a horse over there in the past, so he'll be carrying the New York blue collar hopes. Also worth noting from the California side, from the Pacific Coast, St. Joe Bay for Peter Miller, who has won 3 in a row and tries hard every time. Another hard knocker will be ridden by Nick Arroyo, and he's plenty speed, plenty fast, and will probably make a good showing for himself. One other horse to note is a horse who has not run well. Someone may notice Wild Dude. Wild Dude used to run in the United States and California, and he's running recently in Korea and in the United Arab Emirates and Dubai. He's at a cool 99-1. So we'll see whether he's able to turn back the clock. But speaking about turn back the clock, one of the real interesting horses, and he's just a tremendously hard knocker. It doesn't have quite as many starts as some of the others in here because he's been lightly raced in later years, but is Ronaldo the Wizard. Ronaldo the Wizard is now 11 years old. He's only had 27 starts lifetime, but he's earned over $2 million and had all but 6 of his starts over this racetrack. This is his racetrack. This is home. He runs well here all the time. And he certainly knows how to win races. He's won 10 of 21 at Maidan and 11 of 27 overall lifetime. So Ronaldo the Wizard, just from a pure standpoint of how pure standpoint of horse for course and a pure sentimental choice, we'd love to see Ronaldo the Wizard run another big race. The race following the Shaheem Classic, the Golden Shaheen, is the Shaheem Classic. This is a grass race, huge purse of $6 million, one turn mile and an eighth, filled with local horses, not too much U.S. form that we would speak about, but two horses jump off the page. One is Mondale East, who won the Arlington Million in 2016. Last year and ran in the Breeders' Cup turf to little success, but makes his comeback at the age of 7. So Mondale East certainly is someone whose name will be recognizable. The other horse that everyone knows and Priva will take a tremendous amount of that's the Dubai Turf Classic. I'm sorry. The other horse that has a New York name but doesn't run in New York is Long Island Sound. And it's just funny from people from New York to think of a horse named Long Island Sound who's running halfway around the world. The eighth race is the mile-and-a-half Dubai Shaheema Classic. That's the $6 million purse. And the horse that everyone will know from there is Highland Reel. You know, Highland Reel just ran a tremendous race in the Breeders' Cup Classic last year. Breeders' Cup Turf went wire to wire, beat Flintshire, and really was probably the most impressive turf performer in the United States last year. He followed that up with a fast closing second in Hong Kong Vase Grade 1 race back in December, and now returns here for Aidan O'Brien. Powerhouse, stable, powerhouse connections, and it seems to be a square price at 4-1, a five-year-old son of Galileo. The favorite in that race will be a horse called Postponed. Postponed has done all of his racing. He's 6 years old. He's done all of his racing in overseas, has run in the Arc de Triomphe, and has three starts at this Maidan track, has 2 wins and a second. So Postponed is expected to take all the money, but anyone who remembers Highland Reel from his Breeders' Cup win would probably like to take a square price of 4-1 on him. Finally, we have the big race, the Dubai World Cup. It's $10 million purse, mile and a quarter on the dirt, and of course all eyes will be on Arrogant. Arrogant has done nothing wrong. He's earned $11 million. He could move to $17 million with this win. Seven starts, six wins, culminating with tremendous effort in the Travers, track record-breaking performance in the Travers, following up by the Breeders' Cup Classic, where he defeated California Chrome, and finally the Pegasus World Cup, where he destroyed that field and won in what the comment says was geared down. He has Mike Smith. He has Bob Baffert. He's odds on. Mile and a quarter seems to be right up his alley. Bob Baffert has shipped to Dubai successfully a number of times before. All systems seem to be go with him. And we may see him, this may be one of only three or four starts for him this year. So this may be an opportunity for the world to see how good he is. But we know how good he is, and he's certainly the horse to beat. Other New York U.S. names, rather, that you'll probably know and probably will have a big say in the matter. Gunrunner. Gunrunner has had a nice year, three-year-old year. Came back. His four-year-old debut was delayed due to a quarantine at Fairgrounds, and he missed the Pegasus World Cup because he couldn't ship from Fairgrounds to Gulfstream Park without complications. He came back in the Razorback handicap, went wire to wire over an overmatched field, and looks to be one of the better racehorse older horses we have over here. Bob Baffert is bringing off his horse Opportunity, and Opportunity used to have a reputation as a horse who would hang and not necessarily win. He seems to have gotten over that. He lost to Gunrunner, he lost to Arrogate, but he tries hard every time. He's coming off a win in the San Antonio. He's actually run third over the Maidan course in his one start over this course in this race prior years. He's actually earned $1 million for that one start, which is good work if you can get it. He's a bit of an ATM machine. He just produces money. He earns money every year. He's earned over $4 million without really setting the world on fire as far as particular races. But he is a horse who seems to have gotten more comfortable with age, and Opportunity could round out the exacta behind Arrogate. Other U.S. horses to contend with: the Keen Ice, of course, the horse who vanquished American Pharoah in the Travers 2 years ago. Keen Ice goes for our friends Donegal Racing, Jerry Crawford. Todd Pletcher's over there with Javier Castellano, who does nothing but win. Keen Ice tried the Pegasus World Cup, was soundly beaten by Arrogate. But, again, we know he has a closing style, and if things were to go crazy on the front, or things were to go awry with some of the favorites, Keen Ice could always step up and run a big race. The other race with that, the other horse that's known to the U.S. viewers would be Neolithic. Neolithic is a horse by Todd Pletcher. He finished third behind Arrogate, again soundly beaten by Arrogate in the Pegasus World Cup. Half of his interest has been sold to interest in the United Arab Emirates, and he will in fact be probably close to the lead. Probably show some speed. He's drawn outside, but he has John Velasquez. So all in all, it looks like it might be a race that's familiar to U.S. viewers, but it seems to me like it's largely Arrogate's race to lose, obviously. So with that, we'll mention one more thing. Tomorrow at Aqueduct in the fifth race, a horse called Bobby on Fleek goes for Chad Brown, and that's a horse who they had high hopes for, and I think they hope has a future, and it's nice to see him run. It'd be surprised to go on that. I hope this is going out. I'm not sure what has transpired, if people have had a hard time hearing this, but with that, I think we'll end the show. I want to thank everyone for listening.